Do you ever think of the undead, the ghostly ones crowded under the gravestones?
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Today is Friday, the 31st of October. I'm Ty Grauman.
And I'm Alberta Montelia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our news podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:03 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today, top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
We also have segment two, a piece by news correspondent Emily Blake, who interviewed Maggie Edwards, the general manager of Skywatch Eyes Lodge, Canada's first Aboriginal arts hotel. It had its grand opening in downtown Vancouver on October 16. It is owned and operated by Vancouver Native Housing Society and is unique in its combination of commercial hotel, Aboriginal arts, and culture, and not-for-profit housing.
Later in the program, an interview with Ivan Drury from the Social Housing Alliance talking about their march and protest against the National Conference on Ending Homelessness, as well as a roundtable discussion on this Tuesday's AMS AGM.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, happy Halloween. This is a short PSA reminding everyone to stay safe tonight. Have a spooky Halloween, courtesy of CITR News 101.
In local news, BC Law Society overturns decision to accredit Trinity Western's Law School. Yesterday, the board members of the BC Law Society ratified the results of a referendum that rejects the earlier approval of Trinity Western's future law school, which is set to open in 2016. More than 8,000 of the society's 13,530 members voted earlier this month in a special referendum to overturn the board's previous decision, with 74% of them choosing to vote for the repeal and against Trinity Western. The vote then ratified by the Law Society's board members, who voted 25-1. This decision followed the Law Society of Upper Canada's vote against approving the law school earlier this year. As a reminder, critics oppose the new law school's accreditation because Trinity Western students are forced to sign a Christian covenant that state sexual relations are to be confined within the bounds of a marriage between a man and a woman. This is seen to be discriminatory against people in the LGBTQ relationships. In Nova Scotia's Barristers Society granted Trinity Western conditional acceptance. Should the school change the covenant for law students or allow them to opt out? Trinity Western is challenging those decisions in court, arguing that they have a right to religious freedom.
As well, don't forget to change your clocks back 1 hour on Saturday night. Daylight savings time is done for this season.
In national news, Canadian Security Intelligence Services, CSIS, pushes for bigger budget. According to Ray Boisvert, the former Assistant Director of Intelligence at CSIS, due to lack of resources, Canada's spy agency and the RCMP aren't able to keep track of extremists who may be potential domestic threats. Boisvert, who left CSIS in 2012 and is now employed as a private security consultant, said that the agency and the RCMP have diverted funding and time away from key areas in order to counter the threat of domestic terrorism. In an interview with Reuters, Boisvert estimated that 85% of work at CSIS was focused on counterterrorism. Since it can take dozens of people to properly track one subject, quote, if there are 80 or 90 possible subjects out there, there is no way we are going to be able to surveil them all. Even if we doubt it, doubled the resources at the RCMP and CSIS, we're never going to surveil them all. While Reuters appears to have taken Boisvert's testimony as evidence that the funding of both organizations should be increased, there are other possibilities. The man in charge of the RCMP commissioners, Bob Paulson, said that the surveillance and investigation of potential threats was, quote, a drain on resources, and that the RCMP has moved 250 officers from financial and organized crime investigations to national security teams. Commissioner Paulson said, quote, we've heard someone asking, why don't you put 24-hour surveillance on all high-risk individuals? Well, okay, but there's not going to be anybody doing anything else if that happens, end quote. To what matters most, the focus on Islamic extremists seems not to have prevented recent tragedies. Neither the gunman who launched the attack on Parliament nor the Quebec attacker were among those under surveillance. The RCMP budget last year was $2.9 billion, down from $3.1 billion the year before. In the past 10 years, the CSIS budget has more than doubled up to this past year's $513 million. CSIS itself has been criticized for not being as rigorous as one man might expect of a national security organization. CSIS watchdog, the Independent Security Intelligence Review Committee, said in a report last week that the agency's regional teams, quote, operate in total isolation from one another and communicate only sporadically with their HQ counterparts, end quote. Boisvert was resolute in his call to action, saying, quote, given the current environment, there is going to have to be an investment made by Canadians into a more robust service because we're in this for the long haul, end quote.
Canadian Member of Parliament and former aide and Harper found guilty. Dean Del Mastro, Canadian Member of Parliament for Peterborough, Ontario, was found guilty this morning of violating the Canada Elections Act in the 2008 election. The former aide to Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Halpert has been convicted of overspending by going over his campaign expense limits and is falsifying at least one document to cover it up. The prosecution argued successfully that Del Mastro had ordered $21,000 in services from now-defunct company Holinshed, while Del Mastro claimed he only spent a 20th of that amount. Del Mastro tried to argue that $21,000 were paid for a separate set of non-elections-related services that were never delivered. In her decision, Judge Lisa Cameron said that the documents are, quote, plainly a contract for election services due to their timing and language. When the allegations were first brought against Del Mastro, he resigned from the Conservative caucus and currently sits as an independent. When asked if he would vacate his seat, Del Mastro said, quote, I intend to still occupy it. I've got a mandate from people in the city of Peterborough. I know what the truth is. That ruling is her opinion, end quote.
In international news, Russia is pursuing Arctic oil, including areas Canada claims as its own. Russia has warned that it will revive its claim to a huge swath of the Arctic, with the rights to billions of tons of oil and gas at stake. Russia has completely research on its submission to the United Nations with the potential to gain an extra 740,000 kilometers. Sergei Donskoy, the Russian Minister for Natural Resources, made a statement on the recent research saying, quote, that is a big increase to the country's territory, that why we call this application an application for the future, an application for the future sustainable development of our country, end quote. Mr. Donskoy also stated that Russia's application, which could net it at least 5 billion tons of previously unexploited oil and gas reserves, would be submitted to the UN in the spring. The announcement came as the Kremlin increased its military presence in the far north. Russia's defense ministry said on Tuesday that it was going to build 13 new military airfields and 10 radar stations in the Arctic in case of unwelcomed guests. Under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and five states with territory inside the Arctic Circle, Canada, Norway, Russia, the US, and Denmark, via its control on Greenland, have economic rights over a 200-mile zone around the north of its coastline. However, the convention is open to appeal and several countries are disputing the limits of the zone. Russia believes its shelf is directly linked to the Lomonosov Ridge, an underwater mountain crest that runs 1,240 miles across the polar region. A similar claim is being made about the Mendeleev Ridge, which also strikes out from Siberia towards the North Pole. Canada also calls the Lomonosov Ridge its own and is expected to lay claim to the North Pole itself in a forthcoming application to the UN. Denmark thinks the ridge is part of Greenland.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Give yourself a post-Halloween treat and come down to the Media Club this Wednesday, November 5th to see The Witches with openers Dead Soft and Talk in Tongues. Feral British surf rock trio The Witches are on tour to support their upcoming album, Annabelle Dream Reader. Advance tickets are $12, available at Northern Tickets, Red Cat, and Zulu. Brought to you by MRG Concerts, Beat Row, and CITR Radio.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the unceded Musqueam Territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Mike Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco from CITR's AstroTalk. In our lead story, the sun turns its biggest sunspot in 24 years towards Earth. The sun is now staring down on us with a dark spot that is over 10 times as wide as Earth. This is the biggest sunspot in over two decades. The sunspot, which is over 129,000 kilometers across, has been called AR-12192. It rotated into view on October 18th, and it was clearly visible on October 23rd during the partial solar eclipse. Sunspots are active regions on the sun, where solar explosions, called solar flares, and coronal mass ejections often erupt. This new giant sunspot is the largest of the current solar cycle that began in 2008. And again, as mentioned, it is the largest sunspot observed since November 1990. Since October 24th, this sunspot has produced the following flares: 27 C-class flares, 9 N-class flares, and 2 X-class flares. X-class flares are the most powerful of all. But no solar flare has yet produced a coronal mass ejection which could cause havoc on Earth. Coronal mass ejections are blasts of charged particles that come from the sun's surface, and they could hit Earth and wreak havoc on our planet if they are pointed in our direction. This sunspot, though, is one-third the size of the 1947 sunspot, which has been the largest in this century, or the last century. Anybody who is interested in space weather can go to www.spaceweather.com. In other NASA news, NASA is employing a satellite called EcoStress to monitor plant health in the world. This new space-based instrument will be used to study how effectively plants and forests use water. This space-based instrument is being developed at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. It is called EcoStress because it stands for Ecosystem Spaceborne Radiometer Experiment on the International Space Station. And it will monitor the most basic process in living plants, that is the loss of water through their tiny pores in their leaves. People lose water through pores, and this is called sweating. When plants lose water through pores, this is called transpiration. The EcoStress will monitor forests and plants as transpiration on Earth, but it would also do a combined effect of monitoring the evaporation. So it's a new technique called evapotranspiration. When a person exercises and they sweat, they need water. The same with plants. If they don't get enough water, they overheat and they could eventually collapse. By measuring the evapotranspiration on forests and plants throughout the world, ecostress will help get an early indication of that stress on forests and plants. It can do something about it before the vegetation collapse. As of now, many satellites that NASA deploys are called geosynchronous satellites. They orbit at the same period of Earth, so they only monitor one area on the Earth. The ecostress system, though, can monitor 95% of the Earth's water system. This will help scientists understand global water and carbon cycling in the Earth. In other NASA news, NASA is using a tool called DWR to minimize weather delays. In the heat of summer in Texas, for example, lines of thunderstorms develop in the skies over North Texas, and these threaten to wreak havoc with the timely flow of air traffic headed for Dallas-Fort Worth. But NASA has developed a new tool called DWR, Dynamic Weather Routes, to help airline companies navigate through these storms. If anyone looks at the weather radar, very often that's a grim story. Airlines will lose money if their jets burn extra fuel to avoid storms or if their flights are delayed. DWR is programmed to constantly analyze air traffic throughout the United States, but it also analyzes ever-shifting movements of weather severe enough to require airlines to make a course change. When DWR finds a safer, more efficient route, it dings the air traffic controller a ka-ching, and the air traffic controller then can notify the pilot of an airplane to change its routes. For example, on one flight from Buenos Aires, DWR shaved 26 minutes and $2,500 in fuel costs from that flight alone. Through the past 2 years, 3,355 flights or minutes have been shaved off for 538 flights. NASA plans to spread out and use it across the whole United States. They are also developing a new tool called Next Generation Air Trans System, or NextGen. So hopefully it'll come to Canada. In our last story, researchers have developed the world's thinnest electro generator. Engineers know very well something called the piezoelectric effect. When certain crystals are stressed, that means squeezed, they develop a voltage. When they're stretched, they develop a voltage in the opposite direction. This piezoelectric effect is often used in reverse. For example, piezoelectric crystals are attached to speakers, and when the voltage goes one way, the crystal stretches and the speaker moves. When the voltage goes the other way, then the crystal contracts and the speaker contracts. So piezoelectric crystals have been used for a long time. But now scientists from Columbia University and Georgia Institute of Technology have made a fantastic breakthrough. They have made piezoelectric crystals that are one atom thick. These can be used in so many different ways, it will revolutionize the engineering world. For example, this can be fitted on a person's clothes, and when they walk, the piezoelectric crystal will flex, create a voltage that will power the cell phone. Stay tuned. There's more news in piezoelectric crystals. This is Marco. You've been listening to Science and Technology News.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
And now...
Okay, thank you, Margaret.
For our more dreadful sacrifice.
The music you're listening to is completely electronic.
Only a fool would ignore this.
I'd like to demonstrate for you some of the rather more weird kinds of sounds.
See how relaxed you're getting?
Every Sunday night at 7 o'clock here on CITR 101.9 FM is More Than Human, your weekly guide to all that is new, weird and wonderful in the world of electronic music. So please join me, Gareth Moses, for electronic music old and new, inane comments and the occasional sacrifice. More Than Human on CITR.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a piece by news correspondent Emily Blake, who interviewed Maggie Edwards, the general manager at Squatch Eyes Lodge, Canada's first Aboriginal arts hotel. It had its grand opening in downtown Vancouver on October 16th. It is owned and operated by Vancouver Native Housing Society and is unique in its combination of commercial hotel, Aboriginal arts and culture, and not-for-profit housing.
Hi, my name is Maggie Edwards. I'm the general manager of Squatch Eye Lodge Hotel and Gallery.
So what is unique about your hotel?
There are a lot of things that are unique about the hotel. First and foremost, it's just a beautiful hotel experience. We have 18 hotel rooms, all of which were designed and executed by a team of six quite famous design companies here in Vancouver, in conjunction with six local First Nations artists. The other thing that's really unique about the hotel is that it's a social enterprise, which is a for-profit business that supports the activity of a non-profit business, which in this case is the Vancouver Native Housing Society.
And where did the idea for this project come from?
The idea came from a collaboration between John Zwickel of InVentures Hospitality and David Eddy, the director of the Vancouver Native Housing Society. And they met very serendipitously here at the gallery at Squatch Eyes Lodge 2 years ago. They struck up a conversation and talked about, you know, Squatch Eyes Lodge initially, when it was renovated into hotel rooms, was for patient travel almost exclusively. And it wasn't a very profitable endeavor. And through talking about the hotel business in general, John Zwickel is a third-generation hotelier, and he knows a lot about the business. And Dave Eddy at that point was thinking about closing Squatch Eyes Lodge and just converting the rooms to long-term stay, supportive housing. John told him he could help him make it a profitable business, and the idea for Squatch Eyes Lodge and for it becoming an Aboriginal cultural and art experience started with them trying to develop a for-profit business for the Vancouver Native Housing Society. And so the two of them collaborated over the course of 2 years to execute the idea, and we had our grand opening on October the 16th.
What is the intent of the lodge?
The intent of the lodge, first and foremost, is just to have a very exceptional hotel experience that reflects British Columbia and Aboriginal culture and art. And the secondary goal of the hotel is to create a revenue stream to support the supported housing units, which are located in the same building as the hotel. The hotel has 18 rooms. Supportive housing units, there are 24.
And how was it decided which artists would be involved in the lodge?
I think that happened through a discussion with Dave Eddy and John Zwickel. Dave Eddy has a relationship with many artists. This particular building actually houses people that are involved in an artistic endeavor. They're trying to make a living through art, music, those types of activities. And although that's unique to this particular building, Vancouver Native Housing Society houses more than 1,000 people in downtown east side of Vancouver in supportive housing units. So Dave Eddy has relationships with many Aboriginal artists, mostly through his association with the gallery, which is also housed in this building. So I think he was the person who was pivotal in deciding who would collaborate with the designers and make this happen.
Beyond the supportive housing model, what are some other benefits that will extend to the community?
You know, I think it does a lot of things. I think it creates an environment where you can expose the art of the Aboriginal community in BC to a wider audience, hotel guests from all over the world. It creates a funding source for their goods. They're able to sell their products either at the hotel, to the hotel, or because of the exposure. It's absolutely beautiful artwork. So I think that it creates an environment that's very, very pleasing to our hotel guests.
And what has the reaction been to this project so far?
Reaction's just been amazing. People have really, really enjoyed their stays here. The quality of the hotel rooms is just fantastic. The art that's in the room is very impressive. The overall designs of the individual rooms, which are all different, by the way, every room is different, have been very well received by all of our guests.
And the lodge also offers services of sweat lodge and smudging. Who has access to these services?
Currently, we're offering those services only to our hotel guests. There has to be a First Nations elder that's involved in those types of activities, because we have to notify them in advance that a guest has been requesting these types of services. We generally need a 24-hour notice, so we hope to expand those services to the community at large, but for now we're keeping it to hotel guests.
And what are some future plans for the lodge, or where would you like to see it go?
I'd like to see this model replicated in other communities or within Vancouver and other areas of the city. I think that if this model proves to be successful, that it can easily be copied in other cities and hopefully create a source for funding of supported housing units in other areas. There's a great need in Canada, but unfortunately there are no longer any federal dollars going to supportive housing.
And do you think this lodge also relates to the fact that many Aboriginal people currently live in cities across Canada?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the greatest need for supportive houses is in urban areas, number one. And number two, the percentage of Aboriginal people who are members of the homeless community is much, much greater than the homeless community at large. So I think that there is a great need in the Aboriginal community for supportive housing. And I think that we have to lower those numbers. We have to create an environment where their culture is exposed to more people and where there develops, I think, a sense of pride in who they are and their culture, and ultimately creates cultural independence. I mean, that would certainly be the goal long term.
What else would you like people to know about this project?
I think I would like people to know that I think that it's a very, very exceptional experience, a unique experience, and that whether or not they're just looking for a wonderful hotel experience or they're looking to support sustainable housing activities, that they will really enjoy themselves at Squatch Lodge.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Well, thanks, Emily. I appreciate the call.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill, creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from the unceded Musqueam Territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview with Ivan Drury from the Social Housing Alliance, talking about their march and protests against the National Conference on Ending Homelessness. News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke with him this morning.
Ivan, welcome to News 101.
Thank you for having me.
For listeners who don't know, can you explain what the Social Housing Alliance does in Vancouver?
Well, the Social Housing Alliance is an organization of grassroots activists. Originally, we got together to put social housing back on the agenda in the lead up to the provincial election in 2013. And since then, we realized that the work of fighting to defend the basic idea of social housing and the government policies that build social housing rather than continually erode it, that work needed to continue. Our focus has been and is increasingly going to be around defending communities against forces of displacement, whether from gentrification in Vancouver or other urban spaces in this province, or from the effects of resource extraction and exploitation in other parts of the province. So we see the condition of life in BC is one for most people of being constantly uprooted and pushed around, because most people, working people, students, and lower income people, Indigenous people, are treated as disposable in the society, and only those with money are treated as though they have the right to stay in a place and make a community. So if people who don't have that power of consumption are treated as though they don't matter or worse, they're impediment to growth in a healthy community. So we reject this idea that money makes a healthy community.
The march is being organized for Monday. It's called the March on the National Conference on Ending, which is slashed out, and in place of that is put Managing Homelessness. And that's happening on the same day as the National Conference on Ending Homelessness. So what issues are you hoping to address through this protest?
Well, the problem that we have, there's kind of a double problem around social housing and homelessness. One end is that government funding and action in building social housing has been in constant decline since the early 1990s, when the federal government cut entirely their national housing program and offloaded responsibility to the provinces. And then in 2003, when the BC Liberals came in, they did the same thing locally and eliminated funding for social housing here, offloaded responsibility to no one, really. And in some cases, cities took up some responsibility, but mostly they also abdicated. And today, in this year, in 2013-14, the BC government and the city and kind of all government apparatuses have announced, effectively, they no longer build social housing. And instead, the only people who social housing will be available for will be people who are diagnosed in need of treatment. So people are medicalized into housing rather than having access to low-income housing because of their low income. The effect on the ground has been that homelessness has suddenly become a problem. Poverty has always, of course, been a problem in a capitalist and a colonial society, but homelessness has not always been a problem. In the 1970s, the Downtown Eastside Residents Association, or DERA, they dealt with the conditions of housing in hotels and a lot of other poverty issues, but they didn't talk about homelessness because there wasn't any. But we see that as this policy continues and as things worsen in terms of the income inequality gap and its expression in housing, that homelessness itself is worsening. Under Vision's term here in the city, homelessness has doubled and is at a record high in the city of Vancouver at this point. The response from the government is effectively from a policy level that people are homeless because there's something wrong with them, and they're prescribed housing as part of a medical treatment policy. So management of homelessness and management of housing in these increasingly institutionalized spaces and people surrendering their autonomy and their rights as tenants as a condition of entering social housing has been the wages of getting into housing at all and off the street. And so we think that neither of these things is acceptable. We don't accept that people should be living on the streets or in super precarious, unsafe, or overcrowded housing, which is the case for more than 100,000 people in BC. And we also don't accept that in order to be off the street, you have to give up your rights and your autonomy or dignity as a human being and submit into an institutionalized, supportive housing environment.
Now, so when you're talking about the management of housing, the conference is focusing a lot of its sessions on the housing first model of engaging with homelessness. And it's my understanding that this model has been implemented globally. Do you feel like the housing first model is in itself a management model?
The housing first model is a problem in two main ways. It's a policy shift that comes from the federal government, and they're reorganizing all housing funding around this model, which is supposed to be stemming out of the At Home Say Soi study that says people do better when they're in housing. But they, in order to come up with this finding, they did subject a lot of people to experiments and drop them afterwards back into the street anyhow. But the outcome of the finding is what's important of this study. The policy shift that the study's being used to engineer is also important. The criticism that we have of the housing first model is twofold. On one hand, it's largely a discursive shift that is used to cover for a continued withdrawal from actual funding of building social housing from a federal level. It's allowing for more talk with less action. Secondly, the big problem is that it's enabling a shift at these localer levels, like in BC, still away from social housing and redirecting money towards subsidies for landlords instead of building purpose-built social housing. So the difference here is that to give rent supplements or rent subsidies to individuals under the guise of housing first, saying we can't wait to build social housing, or social housing as infrastructure is not what's needed. What's needed is to just get people into housing, any housing. People do great if they're in apartments, so let's just give people who get very, very low welfare rate supplements in order to get them into market housing. The difference here is that this atomizes and isolates individuals. And as Mona Wilson from Aboriginal Front Door Society explains, breaking up Indigenous communities from the streets and putting individuals into isolated housing alone leads to atomization, depression, and is actually really unstable for those people and leads to them going back to the street. And more importantly, on a broader system level, rent subsidies, they're dependent on that individual receiving them. They need to be constantly renewed. If you are paying rent to a landlord, after 10 years of paying rent to a landlord, you're still just paying rent to a landlord. Do a larger investment in building social housing. After the initial sense of building it, it's then a public asset.
Looking more at the conference, what has the City of Vancouver's role been in organizing and supporting this conference?
The City of Vancouver is part of the organizing body for this conference. They've donated $30,000 towards the organizing of the conference. Part of that is an in-kind donation of the Orpheum Theater for a fundraising event for the conference.
Now, do you think, because we recently had the big push to get people out of Oppenheimer Park, do you think that that push had anything to do with the fact that this conference was coming to the city in November?
That's a good question. I think that the push to get to move people out of Oppenheimer Park had to do with a confluence of problems. One part is that the election was coming and the continued presence of what could become was a political and open eyesore for vision. And the other part could be this conference. I hadn't considered the conference, but it would be, you know, it's kind of building on the existing ironic theme that they have of displacing the Oppenheimer Park camp during Homelessness Action Week.
To attend this conference, the costs range from, right now, because we're past the early bird registration date, it'd be $650 for just a regular citizen and $400 for a student to attend. What impacts do you think these prices are going to have on attendance, the diversity of voices that are there, and the overall effectiveness of such a conference?
The price of the ticket is consistent with the audience that they're looking to have at this conference. This is a conference for managers of the homelessness crisis. It's a conference for professionals, for social work professionals, and for administrators. It's not a conference to talk about homelessness from a homeless perspective, and it's not a conference to talk about homelessness from the perspective of people who are threatened with it or for the people whose communities are shattered by it. It's not a place to strategize and mount a fight back against the government's austerity regimes and to change the reality that we're in order to have a society that doesn't tolerate anyone living on the street. This is a conference to figure out what's going on in Canada with homeless funding. How do agencies correctly line up to access funding through the Housing First model? And worst, what are the innovative solutions? There's always this buzzword, innovative solutions. What are the innovative solutions that agencies can use in order to build partnerships with business and form new kinds of housing models?
There were a number of, an undisclosed number of scholarships available for people who had, quote-unquote, lived experiences with homelessness, and there's a fairly lengthy application process you have to go through. Do you think that that's an appropriate way to try to engage with people who have lived experiences?
Well, I know some people who will be going to the conference with through the lived experience scholarships, but the effect of a scholarship, of a lived experience scholarship on an overall conference like this, is that people are moved into positions of tokenism here. So it's not effective, one, because it's extremely selective and there's major barriers constructed to getting in. So you'd have to really want to go to this conference as a serious thing in order to undertake this.
Yeah.
And anyone who's at all suspect about it would be gatekept out because of the level of work to get involved in getting in. The bigger problem is that it systematically excludes lower-income people and allows their entrance only as exceptions. A high cost is important. Excluding those people who would be an impediment to discussion is important. And the protagonist of this event remains the housing managers.
Right. And my last question for you then, Ivan, that if listeners do want to get involved with this march or with the Social Housing Alliance, what's the best way to do this?
Well, if you want to get involved in the march, it's coming up really soon. So come out on Monday at 5:30. We're meeting at the Vancouver Art Gallery on the Robson Street side, and we're going to march from there to the Sheraton Wall Center, where the conference is taking place. And so there, we'll confront the managers of homelessness and demand action and no more talk. And if you want to get involved in the Social Housing Alliance, you can check out our website. It's socialhousingbc.com. And you can see our website there, and we have general meetings the first Wednesday of every month. That's this coming Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Ivan.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR.ca.
Bam! peanut butter and jam!
What the f*** are you doing, Phil?
Right now, it's time to...
Peanut butter.
Damn.
First you dig peanuts and you dig them. You dig them. Then you crush them. Then you spread them. Peanut butter.
Damn.
Peanut butter.
Damn, mother...
If you're looking for the best in local music and local food, it's got to be Peanut Butter and Jams with your hosts Brenda and Jordy, alternating Thursdays 6 to 7:30. Check it out.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Alberto Montilla.
And I'm Ty Grauman. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have a roundtable discussion on this Tuesday's AMS AGM.
On Tuesday, just over 500 students came out to the AMS annual general meeting in an effort to push the AMS to fight against the recently proposed increases to housing costs and international tuition. If you're just joining us on the issue, here's a brief synopsis. 3 weeks ago, UBC administrators approached members of the student union to unveil a plan to increase international tuition 10% and to hike residence costs 20% respectively. The proposal is now in a 30-day consultation process in which the administration is hearing from student leadership and the general student population alike. The proposal has irked social justice groups and vocal students who have banded together to form a movement aptly named I Am a Student, a play on UBC's now-famed slogan, I Am UBC. At this week's AGM, students made quorum for the first time in 40 years. They passed binding resolutions to officially oppose the tuition and housing fee increases and directed the AMS on its strategy to lobby the administration. With me now to reflect on the AGM and talk about the outcomes it will have, I have student coordinator of the Terry Project and former UBC columnist Gordon Kadick, current UBC news editors Jovana Vranic and Veronica Bondarenko, UBC culture editor Jenica Montgomery, and CITR correspondent Rohit Joseph. How are you guys?
Awesome. Thanks for having us.
We have a full house today for the first time. There's like 20 of us in studio right now.
This feels so Larry King conference. I mean, this is awesome. Yeah.
It's like 20 degrees warmer in here.
It's because of you, Gordon.
Well, then, with that. So I just wanted to move towards talking about quorum. I mean, Gordon, you referred to the AGM as one of the most historic days in the history of politics at UBC. And in the same letter in the UBC, you praise the fact that students were able to reach quorum in the first place. I mean, how do we all feel about the fact that we reached quorum? Is a 500-person or 1% of the student population quorum significant? I guess, Gordon, we'll start with you.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's tremendous. Like, 500 is not a huge percentage of 50,000 students, but we're trying to get 500 students out to anything, especially something as mundane as a AMS annual general meeting. Even though that one was so important, ideologically charged, it was still about like Robert's Rules of Orders and how do we amend this amendment, and you know, it wasn't a lot of fun, right? But still, people were out there and they were passionate about it, so I think it was pretty inspiring.
Right. Do any of you other guys have anything to say about quorum?
I think it was fun. As a culture writer, I'm not super big on politics, but for me, just like going out and seeing just all of these students who managed to come together in a space and just really get their voices out there and get them heard. And it was a lot of fun to see so many people get so excited about such a big issue.
Mm-hmm. I almost feel like to some extent, is 1% representative of UBC? I mean, that it was the most vocal group of people. I mean, mm-hmm. It felt almost like there was 300 people who wanted to be there and 200 people who were brought there by their friends. And I mean, when you're talking about 1% of the student population, and we even lost quorum at one point, I personally don't feel that that's necessarily representative. I understand how historic it was that we made quorum, but I think in part it was also the fact that UBC last year actually reduced their threshold from 1,000 students to 500 in order to try and make quorum. I for some reason, I don't feel that's justified. I mean, does anybody want to fight me on this?
I don't want to fight you. I mean, I totally agree. 1% of the student population, and this was the one radical percent, you know? This was the 1% that were representing the I'm a Student movement and that were really, really passionate about this. And so, you know, they were the ones that were voicing their opinions and voting on these motions. So, like, how do we even know what the rest of the student population even thought of this, you know? Like, even going back to consultations and town halls that UBC has been holding, you know, not many people are coming out, and it seems like not everyone is informed, and the 500 people that were there, most of them were probably informed, and, you know, most of these people were there because they knew about it, and they cared about it, and they don't want to see these things happening, but mm-hmm. where are the people that agree with the increases, you know?
And, yeah, to add to Costa and Giovanna's point, I do agree that, yeah, 1% is not enough. The only thing I could argue, I guess, from the other side is, where are the other outlets for 1,000 kids to show up? Like, I mean, even online AMS elections are hard to get, like, a decent sizable number of people to participate in. And this is online. Literally at the click of your mouse, you can vote, and people still don't come for that. So perhaps, for example, if this is an issue that affects international students, if there was a way you could literally bring it to the residences, have like a grand meeting in a big residence hall or ballroom, I think that might have been a bit more effective. For example, if you want to really bring out the residents and international students, there has to be other ways to engage other people. I think this was literally the only thing that was there. Like, if you know, there's very little choice to work with in terms of which event you're going to pick. I mean, for example, the town halls. Those are great, and I agreed. I believe UBC made an article recently about how the most important players were at the town hall, like Angela Reddish and certain other administration people. But people didn't know about that. Legitimately, most people probably didn't know about that. So I think there needs to be more options, basically, for students to participate and that can get to them. Like,
one could say, though, that this is part of a larger systemic problem that we have here at UBC, that UBC tends to be a very apathetic school. And I don't know if that's necessarily just the fact that it's a large commuter school or what factors lead to that. I don't know.
I would contest that to a certain extent. I think we need to remember that the question of is the I Am a Student movement actually representative of the aims of students? And they are, because if you look at the referendums year after year, there have been now three over my 6 years of being here. That's not 500 people. That's thousands of people voting 91%, 87% the referendum before it. So I think the 500 people there in body actually were quite representative of what students are interested about. I think maybe the reason why there aren't more people in there is because, not because the students don't agree with the ideological aims of the movement, but the students are disillusioned with the political process. The students year after year just feel as if the AMS has no capacity to make change in this regard, because year after year tuition prices have risen.
I mean, we're all really involved in student media here. Is there any way we can contribute to bring students out? I mean, where can we go with you seem excited by this, Giovanna.
Of course I'm excited. I mean, okay, the one thing I keep blabbing on about is social media. It's so important to reach out to your friends and tell everybody, hey, these important things are going on, we should all come out. I'm just repeating it over and over again, and it's a little annoying probably to hear it from me every single day. But you know what? I am so passionate about turnout, you know, just because all these things can be easily, you know, everyone can be easily influenced by their friends. And so why aren't more people coming out on social media? For example, we had our student housing survey, and we had like over 1,000 people fill that out. And that's just because we kept reposting it on Facebook, on Twitter, and all of that. And, you know, part of it was because people cared about, well, why are UBC's numbers on their student housing survey? Like,
are they wrong? Like, they wanted to know what was going on, and so that's why they filled ours out, and they wanted to know what we'd be doing with it, and, you know, things like that. If you just reach out
right.
and tell people this is why this is important, this is what you can do on social media, you know, more people can get involved, and I think it's really easy to do that.
Right. So with a week left in these consultations, where do we go from here, being in the media? We increase our social media presence, but is there anything beyond that we can do to make a point?
It's not only social media, I think, but, you know, just doing whatever we can. I mean, you know, before the AGM, the AMS communications office, they reached out to me and said, hey, like, could you write something about the AGM and share that a bit, just because, you know, people don't seem to know what it is and why they should come out. So I did that, and I wrote a very quick article the night of, and it got shared a lot, and, you know, I reached out to I'm a Student, and they shared that, you know, and so, again, it's just reaching out and sharing things and just making an effort to inform people if you're already informed yourself.
Just if this is something that you feel passionate about, tell five friends, and
yeah.
that will make a difference.
Even if it's not something that you feel passionate about, it is something that is important. So really just keep pushing it. Even if you're not like super into it, if you don't know anything about it, read up on what is already online that the UBC has produced, what the Talon has produced, what any other media outlet has produced. Reach out, inform yourself, and push that on to your friends.
I think another important thing is we can tell stories that make students feel empowered. And really, you just go back to the history of this university and what protest movement, what students' movements have done to not only build this campus, but stop things like development, save things like the farm, save things like the Knoll. So you tell people stories about how, if you do get involved, you can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. So from this place, I mean... Do we feel that, I mean, there was a motion passed that said that the AMS passed a motion to organize student protests until the proposals are struck down by the administration, and we did pass that, but I'm wondering, do we have, should students have the initiative to put these protests into place, or should it be coming from the AMS? How do we feel about this? I mean, I know there was a lot of people very vocal about this issue.
I know I was vocal about it.
Why is that?
I have a pretty good idea of how the AMS works. So maybe I'm a little biased here, but I don't think they're necessarily the platform for this huge, you know, student movement. I don't know. They're just this big policy-making body, and, you know, they want to represent what the students want, but at the same time, they're not really in the place to organize the kinds of things that need to happen, you know, because, as Tanner mentioned at the AGM, we're not a union.
Union, yeah.
You know, we're a society, and a society cannot organize strikes, for example. We can do, like, sit-ins and smaller things like that, and, you know, just kind of get students to do their thing, but the AMS as a body cannot protest. You know, it can get students to do things, but not... Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, no. Veronica, did you want to jump in?
No, I actually see that a bit differently. I think that they can, and they do have the power to, like, rally students together. So, and, like, they do represent the students. So if the students want them to kind of get their word out, then they should absolutely do that.
I mean, to play devil's advocate and to kind of agree with Veronica there, when we're nominating elected representatives to lobby the administration for us, I do feel to some extent that they should listen to us, and whether that means, I mean, they don't have strike capacity, but whether that means in what, like, I think that's what we agreed on at the AGM is in what capacity that they should be fighting for us. And I mean, I would say a gross majority of students said that they should be fighting us for us very vocally.
Yeah, and at least providing resources, information, yeah. And they have the large scale enough communication to reach out to as many students
as possible. AMS Outreach has been posting all of the information about the fee increases. Absolutely. And kind of voicing their opinions coming from the executives and just the body as a whole. So I would argue that they are doing their part. And if people were at the town hall today, actually Tanner Broker, he made some requests. He said that he wanted Arvind Gupta at the next town hall. He said that the consultation should be pushed back and the proposal should be pushed back until the February board. So I do think that they're really fighting for this. You know, they're voicing their opposition and they're doing what they can. And so I don't know how productive it would be for them to try and go out of their comfort zone. You know, I think students can have their own movements going on and the AMS should support that. But the AMS as a body trying to organize anything bigger than what's already going on, I think it might get messy. Right.
But their comfort zone in terms of advocacy has done nothing but make the university comfortable. I mean, it's done nothing to lower tuition. It's done nothing to increase funding to post-secondary education. And I think we can make the AMS whatever it is we want it to be. Mm. And 91% of students want it to be an organization that pushes for lower tuition, that pushes for higher funding. And so why not use the AMS? Like, let's not use the Talon or the Terry Project or CITR. All those are great outlets, but they're not nearly as powerful or as well-funded or as well-organized as the AMS. And we have that capacity to reshape it into an organization that serves our interests.
And I think with that, we're going to end this discussion. Thank you guys so much for being here and commenting on this.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you all for coming in. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
You've either been troubled, you've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no money. The one you love has deserted you. That makes you blue.
Got the blues? Just want to hear some blues? Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 for Code Blue, right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, www.citr.ca. Code Blue.
Yes, how he feels about it. Blues ain't nothing but a man, good man feeling bad, no how. That's all that is.
That's our program for today, October 31st. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Ty Grauman.
And I'm Alberta Montilia. Today's show is produced by Marco Pradanovic. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Now stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.